Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you. What do we have on the agenda today?
Yeah, so we have a packed agenda. We'll first touch on some of the economic data that made news last week. That includes PCE, GDP, consumer confidence, and some housing data. Then we'll do a quick update on the state of the markets, touching on some of the movements that we've seen across both equities and fixed income, and some of the latest retailer earnings. And then finally, we'll have a policy potluck, where we'll discuss a variety of topics, including some coming out of Washington, but then also an update on some of the aggregate banking info that we've seen.
Excellent. Well, how about you jump right in with some of the macro releases?
Awesome. Yeah, to kick it off, last week on the last day of February, the Bureau of Economic Analysis published the Personal Income and Outlays release for January 2025. Through the first month of the year, personal income rose at a robust monthly pace of 0.9%. Personal spending declined by 0.5%, and the savings rate ticked up to 4.6%. Compared to a year prior, so January 2024, the January 2025 PCE price index increased by 2.5%. with the core measure, which excludes food and energy, increasing at an annual pace of 2.6%. From the release, I would say the markets were overall a bit surprised on the income and spending data, with personal income growth coming in higher than expected and spending coming in lower leading up to the release of the report. But I would say that the PCE price index data, which really is a measure of pricing pressures and inflation, was really right in line with market expectations. It showed that the Fed's preferred measure did come down over the prior month by 0.1%, and that's on an annual rate of change. And the core measure fell by 0.2%. So this is overall positive, especially as we're leading up to the next Fed meeting. There are a lot of complications in terms of policy changes, which we'll discuss many of those and the impact on the economy, overall growth and labor markets. But this PCE data is overall was well received, particularly when the CPI data and other inflation reads that we saw earlier came in much hotter than expected. So this being down month on month, that's certainly a positive, but also the fact that it surprised to the upside was also taken positively. I would note, though, that even though the PCE data did show some slight declines in terms of month on month changes in the annual rate, the pace of deceleration is really not all that impressive. And if you take the current recent trend, it would take about 8 or 9 more months for the PCE to be in that 2% range that the Fed would be most comfortable and confident to cut interest rates with. So we're still a ways off, but some positivity, or at least no negativity on that side. Another big piece that came out last week, also from the BEA, was the second estimate for the fourth quarter 2024 real GDP, or gross domestic product. That came out on the 27th. There were major increases in consumer and government spending, which really drove the overall annual pace of 2.3%. That was partially offset by a decrease in investment. But overall, you're still seeing positive real growth across the economy. And this is a second estimate, and it did have a revision of the advanced estimate, or the first estimate, and it revised that estimate up by 0.1%. And that revision was predominantly driven by government spending and exports, and a downward revision to consumer spending. Overall, real economic growth continues to slow, as the annualized pace of real GDP growth in the fourth quarter of 2024 was 0.7% less than the Q3 2024 rate. and was 1 percentage point slower than the average annual pace post-pandemic. So that's if you're measuring from the second quarter of 2020 till now. That said, the current annual pace of real growth is only slightly cooler, or about 10 basis points cooler, than the average annual rate seen between the GFC leading up to the pandemic. And it's a still very impressive, if you put it in nominal terms, so adding an inflation component back in, because that puts us at about a 4.8% annual rate. Now, despite the cooling and the recent cooling that we saw through the end of the year, real economic activity through 2024 showed positive growth. However, what may be more concerning is the potential cooling to come. So on the last day of February, when the personal income and spending data was released, the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now, which is a now casting model of real GDP growth for the forward quarter, plummeted to a minus 1.5% annual pace. And then it fell again on Monday of this week to a minus 2.8%. This is the first time it's really signaled negative growth since the second quarter of 2022. And a lot of this is driven predominantly by the trade and net export contribution to real GDP, but then also to cooling consumption. And when it comes to cooling consumption, I know there were a number of other data points that came out. Cole, what were you seeing on the consumer side?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a data point that came out a little bit before those. So the Conference Board released the results of the Consumer Confidence Survey for February 2024 on February 25th. It showed that the index actually dropped 7 points on the month to 98.3. This is out of a measure of 1985 being 100. So this is split into a couple of different indices, but the present situation index declined 3.4 points to 136.5, while the expectations index fell 9.3 points to 72.9. So typically, the expectations index falling below 80 signals a looming recession. While this figure is not explicitly included in the confidence index, 68% of respondents said that a recession in the U.S. was either somewhat likely or very likely within the next 12 months. That was up from 65% in January. So fewer consumers actually expect business conditions to improve. More consumers expect conditions to worsen for the labor market, and consumers were a lot less optimistic about their income prospects. So put all this together, what are we thinking this means for CRE? Diminished consumer confidence and a pessimistic outlook on the economy will clearly dampen spending in sectors like retail and hospitality. I think a perceived worsening labor market signals some troubling things for the office market and industrial market. So I think you're going to see investors potentially face challenges with tenant quality, indecision about lease renewals. But I think for more savvy investors, probably does present some opportunities in resilient or recession-proof industries or counter-cyclical asset classes. So really interesting as we kind of enter the first day of tariffs here, but consumer confidence data definitely waning as we get through the first couple months of the year. One of the other things I took a look at this week, we got a decent amount of housing data. So the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Home Price Index was released on February 25th. This was for December 2024. So this showed that home prices rose 3.9% annually. That was up from a 3.7% annual gain in November. There are two additional indexes here, the 10-city composite, which rose 5.1%, and the 20-city composite rose 4.5%. So there were some large annual gains in December 2024 in New York, 7.2%, Chicago, 6.6%, and Boston, 6.3%. On a monthly basis after seasonal adjustment, home prices in all three indexes actually rose 0.5%. After slipping every month since February 2024, annual price growth for single-family homes did reaccelerate in the latter half of last year. Prices are still 50% or more above their December 2019 levels across most of the country. And what I thought was really interesting about this, and we discussed this on a different call, was that in the Northeast and the Midwest, which are regions characterized by chronic underbuilding, therefore a limited ability to respond to rising prices with additional supply, these markets have also seen a lot less multifamily construction in recent years. And so I think this may present some attractive opportunities for investors in those markets, since so many remain locked out of the single family market and these markets are not responding, or and it's becoming more difficult to respond with additional single family supply. So really interesting. And on that note, we also got some new home sale data. So the Census Bureau and the Department of Housing and Urban Development released the monthly new residential sales report for January on February 26th, so just a day after. Sales of new single-family homes actually fell 10.5% on the month and 1.1% on the year to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 657,000. As I mentioned, in recent years, new home sales have absorbed, or new homes rather, have absorbed a lot of housing demand since the existing market has kind of remained frozen. But now, and we've said this on a number of podcasts, construction borrowing costs, rising input prices are really hampering home builders' ability to add new supply, not just in some of these older high-priced markets, but all across the country. So new home sales are actually at a level comparable to the 1980s. So as a result, demand that was once supported by new homes is increasingly being captured by multifamily and possibly the build-to-rent sector. And so I think you're seeing the confluence of a lot of different factors here in the housing market. It should be interesting to see if it eases up as mortgage rates continue to tick down a little bit. And I think that's a good transition because I know that you're going to talk about some movements in the treasury yield, which we know obviously directly related to mortgage rates. So why don't you tell us a little bit about some recent movements and some of the market sell-off we've been seeing?
Yeah, so let's take a step back first just to paint the picture of what's contributing to driving yields lower on treasuries. So there's been a lot of macro and geopolitical developments over the last couple of weeks. It seems like every day there's some new potentially framework shifting and shaking up a news story that comes out. And it's really, I'd say, challenging to wrap one's head around the potential implications of some uncertain event or kind of change to the order. And I think that that's really seeping into, you know, whether it's positive, such as a new release of an AI model, or could potentially negative or falling out of some sort of geopolitical tension that's popped up. These are types of events that a lot of investors are always trying to digest, understand what's happening, what the implications are, and then what that means to values. And so over the last week, we've had a few that caught my eye. The first being the U.S.-Ukraine relations souring, that clip that went viral from the White House of what was supposed to be a home run meeting and media appearance turned into effectively a tense argument got on tape. The second is U.S. tariffs on Mexico, Canada, China, three of the largest trade partners starting today, which we're recording on the 4th. And then the third big piece that really caught my attention was that some of that consumer confidence and just the condition of the consumer kind of deteriorating and that being digested by the market and what those expectations would be going forward. That also came into the GDP data that we were talking about. But through the last week, we saw capital markets showing signs of concern and kind of this risk-off sentiment. The yield on the U.S. 10-year Treasury security fell as investors piled into the safe haven asset. If you think, just as a quick reminder, prices down, yields up, or prices up, yields down. As of recording, again, on the 4th, the yield of the 10-year touched 4.1%. This is down more than 20 basis points over the last week and down nearly 50 basis points since mid-February. So if you aren't looking at the intraday movement and you're just looking at end of day or even weekly, you can still see that downward trend. But other signs across the broad capital markets that I would say are almost confirmation signals. You have the price of oil. So if you look at West Texas Intermediate crude oil, has also been falling. That oil usually falls on kind of grimmer economic outlooks. The VIX, or the volatility, the CBOE's volatility index, is on the rise and is as of recording, nearly at 25. It's a level of 25, which is about 30% up from the prior week. Credit spreads are also showing some signs of widening, depending on what ratings you're looking at and what sectors you're looking in, but overall widening across the investment grade as well as high yield space. And then, as you mentioned, the 30-year mortgage rate, even though this is not so much a confirmation signal, but it is also coming down and is at the last, it was last registered at 6.76% at the end of February. That's down about 30 basis points from mid-January. So overall, you're seeing those yields come down. You're seeing volatility up, and there was a lot of red in the equities markets. A lot of that was driven by the tech sector, which is really the largest sector weight on the broad indices. But there were some sectors that have somewhat benefited. So real estate and consumer staples have been leading other sectors across the U.S. equity, broad equity indices. And that's partially attributable to that lower yield environment or the falling yield on the 10-year. Meanwhile, consumer discretionary, energy, and tech are showing signs of lagging, at least over the last week. And just the weights that they have on the broader indices means that they're going to pull the broader indices down. If you do look in within the listed real estate equity space, you can see, you do see a bit more green if you're looking on the 1 week or the 1 month basis of the movements that the share prices of these companies have had. But shares of telecom tower, single family rental, and timber REITs are standout leaders. But overall, real estate has shown quite a bit of green in recent periods. That was a kind of a high level. We'll now go head first and do a deep dive. I know you've been listening to a number of the retailer earnings. What's jumped out to you?
Yeah, this is one of a few weeks heavy with retailer earnings calls. These are delayed about a month after some of the others because they cover the holiday season. But I took a listen to two retailer earnings calls, Walmart and Target. I think these have some kind of revealing management commentary about the kind of health and direction of the consumer. And so I wanted to go through some of their top line results and what I thought was interesting there. So I can kick it off with Walmart. So they actually posted really robust Q4 performance. They saw 5.2% sales growth, 9.4% rise in operating income. Management on the call noted that consumers were resilient. They've seen increased foot traffic, increased website traffic, stronger sales on the internet. But they are quite worried about currency fluctuations, volatility in the broader economy, tariffs. I think these are all going to be challenges. But they think that their diversified businesses, so e-commerce, Sam's Club, membership renewals, advertising, and that these are all going to help them weather the storm. So they're investing in new store technology. They're doing what they can to curb cost pressures. And despite all of this, the results were not enough to please investors. Their guidance for fiscal 2026 is said that they expect lower sales, a lower profit. And actually, February 20th, the day of their earnings call, was their worst day since November 2023. So really, really interesting there. Another tidbit is that this actually marked the first quarter that Walmart was outpaced by Amazon in terms of revenue. So Amazon pulled ahead in quarterly sales for the first time, raking in around $188 billion compared to Walmart's $181. And while both of these are retailers and both have diverse revenue streams, Amazon with Amazon Web Services and their booming ad business, they clearly have an edge over Walmart. And so that's translated into much higher profit margins. And you've seen, so Amazon had a $59 billion profit margin, Walmart just 19.4. So Amazon's market cap now is actually tripled out of Walmart's. I think this just underscores the degree to which the retail landscape has really shifted, even if both of these entities have diverse revenue streams. Now, we'll compare Walmart to a slightly more upscale general merchandiser, and that's Target. So their earnings were actually released on the day of recording, March 4th. And so they showed strong holiday demand for a lot of discretionary items in the fourth quarter, so toys and electronics and apparel. So Target rushed fourth quarter earnings expectations with adjusted earnings of $2.41 a share. Consensus estimates put it at $2.26 a share. Now, net sales did drop on the year to $30.9 billion, but they attribute this in part to a 1 week shorter 2024 calendar year, so one fewer weekend to shop for the holidays. Their same-store sales did increase 1.5% on the year, but they noted declining foot traffic, and compared to competitors, February showed a sharper drop. They've seen underperformance due to some weak results in the past couple of quarters. And after this particular call, their stock dropped 6%. This was despite the strong results, but this is likely due to the call being the same day as tariffs going into effect. And so they explicitly mentioned on their call that tariff uncertainty is going to pressure them in the first quarter 25. Home furnishings and electronics drive nearly two-thirds of their sales, so they are expecting major cost pressures there. They also mentioned groceries on the call. A lot of seasonal produce items that they sell a lot of are going to see cost increases within days, according to management on the call. So they're fairly bearish on consumer spending. They say tariff challenges, sticky inflation are going to have major ripple effects for their customer base. Not too positive of calls, but I think gives us an idea, because both retailers sell an extremely wide range of goods and a lot of value goods. These calls are going to continue to be interesting tidbits for us to talk about the health of the consumer, since they're going to get that data pretty quickly from whether or not consumers are buying particular goods. But Omar, to close out our section on the markets, I know our next segment, we've got kind of a potpourri of various topics. What else did you have on your agenda from last week?
Yeah, every quarter, the FDIC, or the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp, which provides regulatory oversight for depository institutions, aka banks in the U.S., will release a aggregated report. It's the quarterly banking profile, which was released last Tuesday. And while we didn't get to discuss it on our last podcast, I wanted to just give it a quick mention and do the quick rundown of kind of the high level status update of U.S. banks and the role that CRE plays there. So in this aggregated data released on the 25th of Feb, it covers 4,487 banks in the U.S., which have about $24 trillion in total assets. And if you look at their CRE loan book, that's about $2 trillion. The CRE, like, high-level takeaways from the fourth quarter compared to the third quarter of 2024, CRE balances declined by about 0.2%, with the largest quarterly decline seen in the construction and development category, which fell 1.3% over the third quarter. If you look at it on a year-on-year basis, total CRE lending, which is inclusive of construction and development loans as well as multifamily, increased by just shy of 1%, so 0.9% on the year. While this is positive, it's well off the long-term average of about 5% annual growth, 0.9% compared to 5%. Looking across non-farm, non-residential, so that's kind of a bucket category that captures a lot of commercial real estate, there was a 1.4% annual growth seen across all U.S. banks. Multifamily grew a bit faster at a 2.8% annual pace, and then construction and development was down 3.5%. They also break out not just the balances, but they break out the loan performance. And so I'm just going to break it out into two categories. The first is non-farm, non-residential, where they track the 30 to 89 day past due on the entire loan book. That ticked up one basis point to 0.29% over the prior quarter. The total amount of loans that are non-current fell slightly, and it's 1.36% of the total loan book. And then the net charge-off rate for the non-farm, non-res category ticked up about 4 basis points on the quarter to 0.33%. They also break out multifamily as its own category, and you saw more worsening or more deterioration in the loan performance here. So on the 30 to 89 day past due, that was up 18 basis points from the prior quarter at 0.41%. The total non-current rate was 0.94% in the fourth quarter. That's up 20 basis points from the third quarter. And then the net charge-off rate for the multifamily loan book, the aggregate multifamily loan book in the U.S. across banks, was up 9 basis points over the third quarter, resting at 0.19% in the fourth quarter. Some of the takeaways here is that there's been a kind of a long-running narrative or story that the banks are on the sidelines. And I would say that if you look at their balance sheet, they are slowly dipping a toe back in to commercial real estate lending, but nowhere near their kind of like historic average pace, or, you know, I think it's going to be a gradual one. And deterioration and problems that you still see on the loan performance side is indicative of maybe some of the reasons why they have some hesitation is because they're ultimately still working out a lot of loans that they've already made and already have on their books. We can potentially dive into the FDIC data a bit more at another time, but I know that wasn't the only pieces that came out. So what's next in this potpourri?
Yeah, this was a story I thought was worth mentioning. We continue to get some additional fallout from this in the last few days, but I'm calling it a DOGE update. So the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, in the last couple of weeks has taken aim at federally leased office space. So there are some estimates floating around. There's around 173 million square feet of office space across nearly 6,500 buildings that is leased by the federal government or the General Services Administration on behalf of other agencies. These are figures from a recent KBRA study, but the big story here is that the Trump admin has signed a directive to the GSA to cut as many as 300 leases a day. And I'm kind of laughing here because at the current pace, with only around 7,000 leases, this is going to have serious impacts. GSA told Politico that around 3,000 of these leases actually can be canceled without penalty. And so they can really do this at a quick clip. So the KBRA study estimated that the GSA leases actually account for around $30 billion of the $350 unpaid principal balance of CMBS and CRE CLOs as of mid-February. Quite a few of the buildings that are nearly 100% leased by GSA are in the DC area, but a study also called out a couple of other markets, Kansas City, Missouri being one. And just out of curiosity, I typed in just DOGE office space. You just Google News, type it in there. And just in the 24 hours before we're recording this, there are dozens of local news stories about termination of various federally leased office space from in areas like Miami, rural Kentucky, my hometown, Memphis, all talking about offices for Social Security, USDA, Federal Mine Inspection, FDA, just to name some of the ones I could see in the 5 minutes I was looking at this. But that is a significant amount of space, a lot of space that we talked about on the call before. The GSA has been pretty famous in recent years for having signed really short lease extensions and therefore really easy to get out of these. And so I think as we kind of see what DOGE is up to, if they continue to attack some of the federally leased office space, this is going to have major ramifications in the securitized space if some of these 100% leased buildings no longer have a tenant. And so I think it was worth calling out. We're just now kind of figuring out some of the fallout from a lot of this. I think it is going to be concentrated in some of the kind of key metros, but definitely worth keeping an eye out on. So Omar, I know you are also looking at some Trump admin related stories. What's this one you got here?
Yeah, early last week, there was a lot of attention on the proposed Trump Gold Card. So this was announced to be a program to attract affluent foreign investors to the United States, provide lawful permanent residency and a pathway to citizenship in exchange for essentially an investment of $5 million into the U.S. This would really serve as a replacement for the existing EB-5 immigrant investor visa program that some shape or form has been in place since the early 90s. And so I wanted to do a quick comparison of the EB-5, so the existing program, as well as what we know about the gold card and how that might impact commercial real estate. So first, diving into the EB-5 program, established in 1990 under the Immigration Act of 1990, was designed really for the explicit purpose of encouraging foreign investment and economic growth in the U.S. It provides a way for non-U.S. nationals to really obtain permanent residency or get their green card by investing in new commercial enterprise that creates jobs for American workers. It is one of multiple employment-based preference programs that the U.S. offers for immigration, but is one that I know has gotten more attention in the real estate space because it has also served as a source of capital for many projects over the years. Under the current framework that was updated in 2022, the EB-5 program allows foreign investors to invest a minimum of $1,050,000 in a qualifying business venture. They can lower that investment threshold to $800,000 if the investment that they're involved with meets certain criteria, such as being in a targeted employment area, or if they're investing in a qualifying infrastructure project. In the past, many individuals who could qualify and were seeking a path to citizenship in the U.S. via the EB-5 program would ultimately invest in construction and development projects. And part of the reason for that is because those projects employ many Americans through not only the construction, but then once the property is built, through the management of and property maintenance. But there are fewer than 19,000 EB-5 visas available in 2025. And the process is quite lengthy in terms of application, but then also proof of compliance and demonstrating that you've met all the qualifications. That being said, even though it's a bit onerous and it effectively has a cap on how many people can use the program each year, the EB-5 channel has raised about $2 billion per year or attracted $2 billion per year, and much of that going into commercial real estate and infra projects. Now, switching over to what we know about the gold card, it was announced, but there haven't been further details really disclosed. And so we're just operating with the info that we do have. But the gold card program really simplifies and would replace the EB-5 program. It would effectively remove any sort of cap on those that could qualify so long as they can meet the investment minimum. It speeds up the whole processing because you don't have to necessarily apply, prove, and also demonstrate that you had a certain economic impact, which I would say those are two kind of benefits. But it also raises the minimum threshold from about $1 million to $5 million. And that likely shrinks the pool of potential individuals who are not in the U.S., who are seeking U.S. citizenship and have sufficient wealth to effectively participate in this program. It also detaches job creation from the investment dollars. So that's another major component. So even though there are likely fewer people that would qualify and meet the $5 million threshold, it also speeds up the process and path to citizenship. But by removing the linkage to job creation, it also potentially steers dollars away from commercial real estate. Or if it does, if those dollars are still going into commercial real estate, they likely will be going into just the higher return or the highest return investment projects. And so some of the key takeaways here are that the gold card is a much simpler and should be faster process than the EB-5. The pool of qualified candidates changes with that investment minimum. And then the dollars that do come in are likely no longer going towards projects that emphasize job creation or are targeting certain economic zones that are underdeveloped or rural or require infrastructure, but are actually going into higher yield or higher expected return ventures. That could mean that it's not necessarily commercial real estate. And if it is still in commercial real estate, I would expect that to go into more luxury products. So think more development in major markets, be that New York, Miami, Las Vegas, et cetera. So I think it's an interesting update and proposal. I'm really curious to see the details. I think that it could attract foreign capital, but how much it attracts and what it's attracting it to is really still a big question mark for me. But I hope that was somewhat helpful. I found the topic to be interesting, and it'll be something that I follow going forward. But I know in terms of news coming out of Washington that has implications on commercial real estate, I know that's not the last one. So what do you got for me, Cole?
Yeah, I think this is the last topic in our potpourri here, but this was something that was floated throughout the campaign. So proposal from President Trump and congressional Republicans to actually sell federal lands for development, hoping to alleviate the housing shortage. So I think they were primarily thinking about alleviating the shortage through kind of new single family construction, in addition to somehow lowering interest rates. A lot of the details I'm about to give are from a Politico story a few weeks ago. Federal government owns about 28% of U.S. land, but obviously a lot of that is not developable or it has natural significance. But there's a proposal from Representative John Curtis and Senator Mike Lee, both of Utah, to allow states and local governments to actually acquire some of these lands and develop them. Some requirements to keep new housing units affordable if they build multifamily. And I think that this would be mostly used to alleviate housing deficits in areas dominated by federal holdings. So you're talking about, and I assume this is the origin of the proposal, Utah, Nevada, et cetera. And so I think there are a couple of issues with this. Probably does only work in such areas in the Mountain West and Southwest where there are significant empty land holdings with close to infrastructure. I think others think that it is not going to solve the housing crisis. So if we're going to risk losing public assets without making much of a dent, this might be a difficult proposal. But the White House is focused on vacant surplus land in established areas. And so a little bit different than just the 28% of land owned by the federal government. That's a lot of natural protected areas. But this did get me thinking. I did go on a recent trip to Las Vegas for the NAIOP conference back in October. And obviously, one of the huge barriers to outward growth in the Las Vegas Valley is that it's surrounded by federal land. So that's the Department of Defense or the Bureau of Land Management. And it's not just residential developers that want some of this, industrial as well. So I know that there are a lot of developers that would love to get their hands on some of the parcels owned by BLM and the DOD throughout the I-15 corridor, at least, where there's a lot of demand for industrial development. But I've also seen estimates that particularly in the Las Vegas area, at its current rate of build out, there will be no developable land left that isn't owned by the federal government within a decade or a decade and a half. And so I think this is kind of interesting. One of the reasons that I think there is such a housing crisis in the U.S. is that the abundant housing is not near the abundant employment. And so I don't expect that if you were to solve this backwards by building more homes in places where the jobs are not, that we would be able to solve this. Ultimately, I do think it's an interesting proposal. I think there are a lot of federal land holdings that probably would be prime for development. And so I'll be interested to see where this goes. But just a small anecdote about what's going on in Clark County and what some of the folks in the Mountain West are thinking about this, but definitely a story I'll want to follow up on if we do see some of these go up for auction. So I think we do have a couple of announcements. I know there's some upcoming data releases and earnings calls. So to walk you through some of those data releases, March 11th, that's a Tuesday, we'll get the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index. On the 12th, the Consumer Price Index. On the 13th, the Producer Price Index. And the 14th will be the preliminary March readout for the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index. And Omar, I already mentioned the retailer calls, but I know there's a couple that are probably worth paying attention to next week. What do we got?
Yeah, so on Tuesday the 11th, Dick's Sporting Goods and Kohl's report. And then on Thursday the 13th, Dollar General and Ulta Beauty. But I also want to, so that's, those are earnings calls that are on the radar, but I also want to flag to the listeners, if you made it this far, that the industry conditions and sentiment survey, the first quarter 2025 survey, is still open. It will only be open for a few more days. We strongly encourage you to participate. And if you do participate, it's about a 10 to 15 minute survey. You can put your email at the end and you'll get all the data as soon as we've aggregated it and written up the key observations. So you can get the underlying data sent to your email. But we will include a link in the show notes for you to access that and complete it.
Excellent. Omar, I think that is all the time we have today. But before we sign off, I do want to encourage listeners that if you like the show, we would love it if you could rate it. Give us 5 stars on Apple and or Spotify. And feel free to leave us comments there as well. We will read them. Feel free also to just send us an email at altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We would love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program. In the meantime, Omar, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast, powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.